Welcome to the Ancient Christian Writers series, led by Father David Abernethy of the Pittsburgh Oratory of St. Philip Neri in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The following recording is a reading and discussion of The Spiritual Life by St. Theophane the Recluse. Our ability to provide podcasts free of charge is made possible by the generosity of listeners like you. If you would like to make a contribution in support of our ministries, please visit www.thepittsburghoratory.org. Your interest and prayerful support are appreciated. God bless you and enjoy the podcast.
Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth. Hey, welcome back, everybody, to our study of St. Theophane's correspondence with young Anastasia. And we're picking up with a new letter here this evening, letter 49 on page 200. And so we're moving along quite nicely within the text. And this will be a good one for us to consider this evening. He switches his focus just a little bit. He'll be coming back to the remembrance of God in the following letter. But this letter has to do with how we look at the burdens of life and our spiritual life and the life of prayer. And by burdens of life, I think he simply means our worldly labors, and that there's often the temptation to think that one can only live a deep and rich spiritual life and have a deep and rich prayer life if one escapes to the monastery or to the desert somewhere. And yet we've seen in just about every writer that we've looked at over these years calling that into question, that it's not just those in black robes or black habits who are called to a life of holiness. And so what he'll be talking about here is that there's no distinction between the worldly and the godly life, that the godly life is to permeate everything that we do, regardless of our state in life and the kind of work that we do in this world, and whether we're a monastery or married or single. And we've often had a difficult time. You know, there's kind of clericalism that, you know, affects the church in multiple ways. But there's a kind of clericalism that I think can say, well, okay, the priests, the religious, you know, they're the ones who are to live this, you know, rigorous ascetical life and life of prayer, and those living in the world, you know, have their particular work, and that somehow disconnected from this. He calls this in the question, as so many before him have, that certainly the role of prayer will be different for a person living in the world, but how one engages in one's work and how God is at the center of that work is really what he'll be looking at in this letter. It's an important challenge. I think the Second Vatican Council emphasized this in the sense of the universal call to holiness, but it's never been articulated very well what that means. And certainly it's rarely meant reading somebody like St. Theophane the Recluse or St. John Climacus and having them as guides. We're, in some sense, the council was saying, we are to go back to the resources of scripture and the writings of the fathers, but that has not been all that effective, or I shouldn't say effective. I mean, it hasn't taken place in great measure. Most of the time, there seems to be a picking and choosing of various elements of the spiritual life rather than an in-depth study. And so again, we're picking up with letter 49 on page 200 of the text, entitled The Burdens of Life. I shall continue addressing your complaint concerning the disorderliness of thought that is the result of life's everyday occupations. What if there is nothing to do? There would be sinful idleness. You need to work and to do things around the household. It is your duty. External considerations should not interfere. You must keep doing them and do them in a fitting manner. It is the duty of human society. All of this kind and all occupations, however, may be performed and must be performed in such a way so as to not disrupt thoughts about God. How may this be accomplished? So, regardless of the work that we are engaged in our life, that we are still called to have this constant remembrance of God, that this is really key to Theophan's thought as a whole. And I think it's the thread that runs through all of his letters to Anastasia, that it is the constant remembrance of God, in particular through the Jesus prayer, that remembering him, turning to him, seeking his grace is the thing that is transformative, whatever our station in life is to be. And so he's not, you know, going to let this pass easily for her. You know, I think she's complaining a bit about the disorderliness of her life and that the work that she's called to do, which at this moment is in the home, seems to be a distraction to her. That, you know, she wants to have this life of more steady prayer and has not been able to achieve that to this point. And so he wants to make it clear to her right from the beginning that whatever the work is to be performed, this remembrance of God is not to be disrupted in any way. We have a popular belief, fairly widespread, and that's an understatement, that holds that as soon as you occupy yourself with work around the house or your place of business, you've already left the sphere of godly things and things pleasing to God. Thinking this, when you get the desire to live in a God-pleasing way or begin to talk about it, there's usually a thought that accompanies it that says you must run away from society, leaving home, and go to the desert or the forest. This is not the case at all. Life's everyday affairs, upon which the foundation of the home and society depend, are appointed by God. And carrying them out is not a desertion to the sphere of the ungodly, but a continuation of godly affairs. So God himself has created things in such a fashion and requires things, that there is work that is necessary to be done to sustain us and to sustain society and one's family. And so to see this as coming is from the hand of God and part of God's providence means that holiness must be able to be found within the accomplishment of it. And so we can't allow ourselves then the luxury of thinking, you know, that holiness can only be found in the monastery and that a godly life can only be found in sort of this utopian vision that we have about the spiritual life. Certainly, even in monasteries, it's challenging. They have their work to do as well, their daily obedience that they have to accomplish. And so it's not like they sit around navel-gazing all day long. You know, they're very much engaged in their daily duties and have to do that with a remembrance of God as well. Natalia Wohar.
Hi.
Hello.
I just wanted to add that this paragraph reminded me of one of the opening prayers in the Byzantine Rite, like, Heavenly King, Comforter, Spirit of Truth, everywhere present and filling all things. I just have always found great comfort in that, and I think it coincides with this paragraph, so wanted to share.
That's right. Well, everywhere present, and I think that's the important thought there, and what he would want her and all of us to hold on to. That this sense that God is everywhere present and in every work that we are engaged in, whether it's mopping a floor, cleaning a room, or in the office, you know, engaged in some particular work, or as a doctor or a nurse or whatever it might be, whatever the labor is to be done in a godly fashion and in a way that directs us towards God and is pleasing to him. And what that looks like, he's going to lay out for her here. But we have to work very hard to rid our minds of this thought. And because I think even within the church, there will be those who will give pushback about this, you know, in the sense when one begins to take up one's spiritual life in a more rigorous way and to engage in the life of prayer in a more thoughtful way and creates a role that's called into question, that somehow, you know, that this isn't supposed to be a part of our life and what shapes it. And in some ways, it's simply an easy out, I think, from having to be disciplined about one's life as a whole and about one's relationship with God. Holding such an incorrect belief, he tells her, everyone thus acts as if they do not have to be concerned with thinking about God as they go about their everyday business and social life. I see that this belief holds sway over you. You must resolve to rid yourself of it and form the conviction that everything you do around the house or outside of it, as part of the everyday affairs, as a daughter, as a sister, as a Muscovite now, is both godly and pleasing to God. There are special commandments regarding everything here. How can carrying out these commandments be displeasing to God? You are making them displeasing to God just because of your belief, because you are not carrying them out with a disposition that God desires you to have when carrying them out. You're not carrying out God's affairs in a godly way. They're being wasted in vain, and the mind keeps driving them away from God. And so the labors are to be taken up with a certain disposition of mind. And this is what often eludes us, that we can be drawn into a particular labor, and we can resent it and so grumble the whole time that we're doing it, just hate it. Or we can be so absorbed by it that it becomes the thing that, you know, forms and shapes our identity, that we're so pulled into it or takes on this level of meaning for us that God gradually slips out of the picture and we're no longer doing it for him or to please God, but rather to satisfy one's own ego, that it becomes the source of our identity and gives us a sense of purpose and meaning, rather than that being something that flows from God and then affects the way that we engage in our work. And so this is, you know, he's trying to get her to have, again, the right focus upon the way that she's approaching the things within the home. And one can imagine, you know, as a young woman working at home, we already know that part of her work was to help in the care of the family. And, you know, whether it was cooking or cleaning or things such as that at this point. And so some of that might have, you know, certainly have lacked any kind of glamour and was not, I can't imagine it being very romantic in her eyes, you know, in the sense of fulfilling any grand purpose. At this point, it would have, I'm sure, seemed menial to her. And so her mind would have been either flitting to things that seemed of greater importance or this idea of leaving the world so that she could be unimpeded in her pursuit of God and the things of the spiritual life. Meanwhile, she's letting every moment slip by and all of those labors slip by in vain, that she's not being attentive to God in the performance of them. You know, to perform an act of taking out the garbage with love, you know, either for others in the house or with, again, a mindfulness of God, that this is what he's called me to do at this moment. And so even how I do this simple labor, if I take it up, you know, without resentfulness and bitterness or like, ah, oh, do I have to do this again? You know, as it's a bother kind of thing, that, you know, this can bear great fruit in a person's life. When we set aside the will or set aside ego, you know, for a moment. And in some sense, it might bear greater fruit for us than the things that seem more grand within this world. That often there's very much of the ego involved in those things, and people exalt them in this world. I mean, think of the professional athlete. You know, certainly being an athlete isn't opposed, you know, to the spiritual life or being a child of God. But, you know, in our world, in our culture, there's the exaltation of the athlete, almost as if they are a god, you know, that they have these unique capabilities and are paid these exorbitant salaries, and that this is what's admired. And so it's not only the individual, but those who follow them that sort of get wrapped up in this notion. Correct this then, and from this point on, begun doing all things with the knowledge that doing them in this way is a commandment, and do them as God's commandment is to be done. Once you have set yourself to this, there's nothing that will turn your thoughts away from God. On the contrary, everything will bring them closer to him. All of us are servants of God. He has appointed each person a place and occupation, and he looks to see how each one of us carries it out. He is everywhere. He looks after you too. Keep this in your thoughts and do each thing as if it were entrusted to you directly by God, no matter what it is. So, you know, you can begin to see what the reason why he says what he does in the previous paragraph. You make them displeasing to God just because of your belief, because you're not carrying them out with the proper disposition. And the proper disposition is that the work that you are doing is given to you not by another, you know, around you, and not taken up simply even by your own will, but it's given to you, entrusted to you by God. And so you take up that labor as if having directly received it from his hand. And that simple shift in disposition can make all the difference in the world, and also for eternity, that the smallest things that we take up are, in a sense, freighted with destiny. They have a dignity about them, no matter what they are, because they come to us from the hand of God. And so they become a source of grace for us. If we take them up in a spirit of obedience or of humility, of love, of selflessness, then they take on immense meaning for us. And if we take them up grumbling, or if we are simply oblivious to that reality, then we aren't going to be doing it with the proper disposition. Eric.
I'm reminded of the saying that we can't all do great things, but we can all do little things with great love.
That's right. And, you know, let's take an example of the monasteries, especially Eastern monasteries, often will describe the daily labors that the monk is doing. You know, if he's the cook or if he's cleaning a certain room, it will be described as their obedience. It's not described as their work, you know, because that's too vague, that they're fulfilling it as an act of obedience, and not simply to the superior or whoever is over them, because the superior has been given his position by God himself. And so the obedience that is being done is being done in response to God, who has determined in his providence that this should be given to us. And so we would take it up with a zeal, a kind of joyfulness, peacefulness of mind, not rushed, you know, not in it with a frenetic pace, but not with a kind of sloth either. You know, that we would be fully attentive to what we were doing, again, with this heightened sense of who we are doing it for. And where this is most important, I think, typically for us, is probably in the things that we dislike the most on a given day. You know, it's easy to have this group. It's like, oh, I get a burst of energy and it's fun and we laugh and we have these great conversations and I'm energized so much that I can't go to sleep after the group. But, you know, if it's taking out the garbage or doing the dishes or something like that, you know, it can be another thing. And so to be attentive in those moments is actually more important. You know, because I think when we begin to neglect those smaller things, or what in our mind is seems smaller, then we are also going to eventually neglect the greater things, or will not have the greater things entrusted to us because we have not been faithful in the small things that have been trusted. If we can't carry those things out with love and selflessness and humility, why would we be entrusted with something far greater? And so, you know, and here we're only talking and have only talked so far about certain menial labors. I mean, we're not talking about, say, raising a child or changing a poopy diaper, you know, or something like that, or, you know, tending a child who's ill. Miron, you're going to be doing that a lot pretty soon. No, I can't even imagine that. So it's just like, good luck to you there, my friend. I'll be praying for you and your acts of obedience to come. And especially in those little things, you know, and we can see how our society would make light of them or turn them into a burden or begin to say, well, my life isn't fun anymore, or begin to find ways to escape it, you know, into video games or television or whatever it might be, to neglect giving attention to the other. And this has come up in other groups, you know, Simone Weil talking about that being one of the most important virtues that we never even think of as a virtue, of being attentive to those around us, showing attention and being mindful enough about what is going on in another's life that we seek to ask them about it. Sometimes we can even see that somebody's struggling and we'll do that little thing where we sort of turn our eyes away from it and pretend that we didn't see it and not approach in order to engage to say, how are you? Or is something going on? Because we don't want to be pulled out of our schedule. And, you know, often we will, it's a curious thing, often we will fill our schedules, we'll become so busy in such a way with the things that we want to be busy with in order, again, to satisfy our own egos. But we can also do it as a kind of avoidance, you know, avoiding of the things that really require more from us on an emotional level, or require the mortification of the intellect and reason and of our will. You know, it's, you know, when we work, you know, 12 or 16 hours a day, you know, we can tell ourselves in our mind, boy, that was a busy day and I accomplished a lot. But we can also be neglecting some pretty important things. We could be neglecting God by working these excessive hours. We can be neglecting family, children, and simply, you know, friends, and or those whom God might bring on our path. And because we are so frenetically busy that we don't see them. And, you know, Philip Neri used to do this thing in his priesthood that he would go and wait in the church for people to come in for confession. It wasn't as when he started, it wasn't as like there was this huge line and he was, you know, in the confessional for hours. He would be in there waiting for people, whether they came or not. Because this in particular was his duty, his obedience as a priest, administering of the sacraments, making himself accessible precisely to do that. And if you think about it, you know, how hard it is to find a place to go to confession often, because other things, you know, rise in their import in people's mind. And so one of the fundamental acts of obedience for a priest is neglected. And there can be a whole host of reasons to come forward for that. But nonetheless, it's not doing that work. They're not doing their work in a godly fashion. Certainly being attentive to things that are of lesser importance, but we have somehow magnified and importance is not doing them in a godly way, and it's not going to be pleasing to God. We may be neglecting the fundamental, in fact, the fundamental parts of our life. So this is, you know, what he's giving her here, I think, is, you know, far sweeping in terms of how we look at our life as a whole and the place of God in every single moment. It's not even sort of taking up that work with a particular disposition. It's having this mindset that we are attentive to that which is most important, also what God has given us to do providentially. Any thoughts before I move on to the next paragraph? Okay. So we're at the end of that page, right? 201. Do everything around the house like this. And when someone from outside comes by to visit and you go call on somebody yourself, keep in mind several things. First of all, God has sent this person to you, and he is looking to see whether you receive him and relate to him in a godly manner. Second, God has assigned you a task outside the house and is watching to see whether you will do it in the way he wants you to. So a couple of things there that, you know, again, God can send us particular individuals that we are to be attentive to. And do we, again, acknowledge that? Or are we oblivious to it? Are we absorbed in ourselves and our own affairs? Or are we able to receive people with the kind of hospitality and love that God would have us receive them? And I'll be right with you, Jim and Joyce. Just one more thought while I have it on my mind. You know, it's even as a priest, we have a little joke about being front desk. You know, when you're trying to get upstairs for evening prayer and dinner, or if you've spent an hour and a half in the confessional and you walk out and like Ren will ask you to do something or Becca sign this check or whatever, and then somebody comes in the building and asks you a question or is to talk to you, and then you get front desk, you get caught at the front desk, as it were, and you're knocked off of your path. I'm going to get upstairs, I'm going to read and prepare for the group, and the next thing you know, you're in this unexpected appointment, and you think, oh gosh, I should have gone up the back stairwell. One of the things that we dislike the architect, we love the architect who built the building, but he made the door into the building from the garage come in right where the main conference room is in the building. So if you're coming in from somewhere outside or from your day off, you'd walk, and to get to the elevator or the stairwell, you'd have to walk into this space where typically there were dozens of people standing after a group, and everybody would see you come into the building. And it's like, so we eventually drilled and cut through cinder block to put in another door and do another, and into another stairwell. And not that I'm saying that we should not have an opportunity to rest, but there can be something about that, you know, our avoidance of this disruption that God can bring into our life for a particular reason. And sometimes there are people that we don't want to talk to because we anticipate it's going to be very difficult. I remember as a young priest, and there were younger priests than me, and somebody had just gotten out of Western Psych and had come to the oratory seeking to talk to someone. And it was a guy who had, you know, makeup on, his fingernails painted and things such as that. And, you know, freely admitted that he had just been, you know, let out of Western Psych. And yeah, I was a young priest at that point. And it was like, you know, okay, this is above my pay grade kind of thing, and was feeling unprepared, or just, you know, felt that experience, you know, felt that in my heart saying, you know, wanting to get away from it or not having to deal with it. I did, but that can be this kind of improper disposition that St. Theophan is talking about, that there is not this availability and accessibility to the other in love that we have in our lives. Again, we can make ourselves so busy or simply become so proficient in avoiding that we aren't engaging. So he's telling her here, you know, when somebody comes to your house, how do you engage them in this godly fashion? Do you receive them as you are receiving Christ himself, basically, is what he's telling her. And also, if you go out into the world, are you attentive to the fact that God is watching how you're engaging in those realities? And are you engaging in whatever it is that you're called to in this godly fashion? So Jim and Joyce.
Sorry.
Okay, go ahead.
Can you hear us?
Can you? Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so it's kind of a twofold question. So how do you practically, I'm not sure, I know you're supposed to give glory to God for everything, but like I'm missing the how to do it practically. Mm-hmm. And then also the same with seeing Christ in other people. Like, you know, you donate money, but am I donating it because it's the right thing to do or because I see Christ in those people?
Right.
Hence?
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, you know, I think this is why he surrounds this letter with this constant remembrance of God, that it's only by the grace of God then that we have the capacity to discern, to see with the eyes of God, and to be able to see in the other one that we are called to love. And it's only in and through this constant communion with God that we find the grace then to step out of the world that we've created for ourselves and step outside of the walls that we surround ourselves with to protect us in order to engage the other person. So ultimately, it is only by the grace of God and through the constant prayer, the unceasing prayer that he's been speaking to her about, and what he's going to come back to the very same thing in the next letter, because the two are so intimately tied together, that it's not simply by sheer force of will or by our own mindfulness of this, you know, our capacity to be mindful in the way that we need to and to engage in these things with a godly disposition only comes as a grace of God, which is true of everything in the spiritual life. And this is why that constant remembrance is so important, that there's nothing that comes to us, nothing that we do, nothing that we suffer, you know, that is outside of the grace of God, or that is in some way disconnected from him. So living in this constant, with this constant remembrance of him and living in this constant communion is the thing, one thing and the thing alone that allows us to engage it then with this godly disposition. And so you see in the world, in some sense, the attentiveness and the vigilance in prayer and with one's thoughts almost becomes more important. You know, one might say that one would go to a monastery because they see that they are weaker in that regard, that they need that structure and that kind of order of life to help them develop that attentiveness, you know, to live in the world and to be engaged in these various activities and to be mindful that we're doing them in obedience and that we're doing them as a matter of providence and have to be calling out for God's grace requires a great maturity of faith and discipline in our life of prayer. Otherwise, we're going to become more and more proficient in our escapism, you know, losing ourselves in things that we don't have to be mindful to anything else. You know, it's almost said as a joke now that, you know, guys are, instead of getting married, they're in their 30s, mid-30s, playing video games, because that's far more, you know, preferable than to being married and having kids. You know, if I could just escape into this virtual reality in the evenings in between work, you know, that then I don't have to be bothered, you know, by these other things, which seem to be an interruption into this narcissistic world in which an enormous number of people live. these days. This narcissistic bubble and anything that sort of gets in the way of that and the satisfaction of that is rejected. I saw a little video and, you know, it's, you know, a question was put to people online, you know, what is it that you want to tell people, you know, that, you know, one thing that you regret? And a guy was holding the phone and he turned it quickly like this too. It was either his wife or his girlfriend that was sitting next to him. And he did that real, you know, quickly a couple of times and she picked up on it and let him have it for it. You know, it was like that relationship had become the thing, you know, something that he had regretted. And likely because it requires greater work. You know, there's a kind of dying to self and giving ourselves in love and serving the other. And again, it's, you know, it doesn't seem fun, you know, as fun as that virtual reality of games. Eric Chastain. I can't hear you. You got to speak up again there, buddy. Hello? Not hearing you. Anybody else have a question while we're waiting once again for Eric? Eric, are you there? Oh, he froze now. Okay, Catherine.
Yes. Oh, no. I'll say something short. I was just going to mention, especially since you were talking about parenthood a lot, that I think, you know, there's definitely sort of like a paradigm shift that ideally you would make at some point. I think a lot of the times the question we ask ourselves, like when interruptions arise, is like, you know, why should I do this? Is there a good reason for me to do this? And I think like children, especially because they are kind of so incessantly demanding, often just sort of necessitate a shift to, is there any good reason why I shouldn't be doing this? And it's just like an instantaneous, like, is there some excellent reason to not do this or not take care of this need? And if the answer is no, you just do it. And so in a way, you talk about parenthood, but I do think it can be a great training ground. And I know for non-parental vocations, there are other opportunities, as you were discussing, but just to sort of really experiment with putting yourself completely at the disposal of every person and every interruption that comes your way and just, you know, seeing how it goes, you know, because after a while, like, I mean, I remember in the early days as a parent, like that kind of like tension in the shoulders when like you take that sigh and you sit down and you think, oh, finally I get to think and breathe and then back on duty, you know, but I think like eventually, you know, when it just talks about like forming that habit, like I think eventually you get to a place where like you don't clench up and your first thought isn't feeling angry, but like, yeah, it takes a lot of practice. So I was going to say parenthood is tricky, but it's a great training ground for that kind of thing because
do husbands do the things that you just mentioned?
Ideally, yes. Or they serve their wife and then she's serving their baby maybe more directly more of the time, but it all evens out. That would be the ideal, you know.
Yeah. And you know, I'm often amazed. You know, there are many families that I've come to know over time. And you know, there's one young family that I know that has 7 children now. And, you know, just the order of their day. You know, getting the kids up and going, and they do homeschooling too, and which must be a nightmare in terms of trying to get everybody dressed and going and breakfast, and then it's begin their studies, and then you probably turn around and start making lunch, and getting to bed, they've told me, is just like, you know, takes forever, and then they're jumping out of bed and wanting to, you know, talk and running around, and so grocery shop, and you know, they have to figure out the meals for the week, and they have to go grocery shopping a couple of times, you know, just to keep food in the house. And you think, okay, for a couple to be able to see that and see the beauty of it and find joy in it, and they can have laughter in the midst of it and even laugh at the days that turn out to be complete chaos, You know, they could see that it just got mad at some point. And it's not that they don't fight. You know, I'm sure they fight vigorously at certain times, but nonetheless, you can see that what arises out of that is extraordinary grace, and also then something of the joy of the kingdom that comes not from embracing something that is easy, but the giving and receiving of love, the giving of the self and giving of love to others, and also receiving it from them in return. And there's something extraordinary there that those with a more worldly mindset would never understand, you know, that, or the more narcissistic, you know, approach to things would never understand or grasp, because all they're seeing is the difficult parts of it, changing the diapers, or, you know, running to the store again, or trying to get the kids to bed. They see the hard, you know, how difficult that is, and only want to avoid it, but never coming to taste anything of the deeper joy of that. Eric Chastain is back with us here again. Is your sound on? I think he's frozen again. Hello. Yeah.
He's frozen.
What's that?
He's frozen.
Okay. We'll give him a chance a little bit later. Anybody have any other thoughts or comments about that? So you see how, again, how far-reaching this is, and how, you know, deeply it touches our life as human beings, you know, often in these very hidden areas of our life, and the small things that nobody else in the whole world sees, you know, what goes on in the day-to-day life. And if that's taken up with love, a disposition of love and humility, it's sanctifying. It's transformative. Eric, is your head bobbing again? Are you back with us? All right, hurry up. Spit it out.
Thanks be to God. Okay, it finally worked. So I was wondering Theophan gave kind of, you know, fitting examples for domestic women. And sometimes there are situations that men can be in out in the world, if they're in extremely demanding jobs that involve lots of mean people who are constantly kind of like insulting them and stuff like that, or, you know.
Meaner,
like,
meaner people than little kids?
Well, there are lower stakes perhaps with the kids. I don't know. I think there are difficulties for sure with kids, because they can do stuff that's unpredictable and really weird. But you know, politicians, let's say, I don't know, they're meeting with all sorts of really, really mean people all the time, and they're really you know, expected to be on 24/7, and they don't sleep very much and things like that. So I'm wondering, kind of, how do you scale what Theophan, well, I wish that Theophan had written a version of this kind of advice for those kind of people who are unfortunately very deeply in the world and in human affairs, because it seems harder to do the kind of thing. It is possible for sure to do the kind of thing that he's describing in such settings, but it seems much more difficult. And I'm just wondering what you would make of that.
Yeah, I think my first thought was your word seems. That I think that's an important word. It seems more difficult and seems to require more. But I think somebody entering into the world and having to engage all these individuals, you know, that, you know, maybe where they're, you know, our humiliations or insults or being treated in an arrogant or demeaning way, that, you know, that one is to meet that in a Christ-like fashion. I mean, in some sense, it wouldn't it wouldn't have any value for Theophan to begin to articulate what one would do in this or that circumstance, because it would take him forever and he wouldn't be able to touch on every different reality that a person finds himself in. You know, what we are to do is to conform ourselves to Christ, to put on the mind of Christ, and the shape of the way in which we engage others, and the love that we show to others, regardless of how they treat us, or maybe especially when they treat us in the arrogant way or the humiliating way, is always to be cruciform. You know, this is our love, is to have this shape, self-emptying. It's, we are to have the humility of Christ, and we are not to give back, you know, anger for anger. You know, turn the other cheek, do not resist one who is evil. That we are to conquer with love. And so it does, again, require, you know, this kind of depth of one's prayer life and constancy in that prayer, and where we are acting out of that communion with God in order that we might love in a godly fashion, to love the unlovable, to forgive the unforgivable, and to treat those who treat us in this demeaning way, not by, again, putting up walls that are high and thick, or taking out the big guns and going after them ourselves because we feel justified in doing so. That, you know, part of being a Christian in this world is that we are not going to feel at home, and that we are not going to be, you know, exalted in the eyes of the world. Blessed are the poor, blessed are those who are mourn, you know, blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. You know, Christ turns everything on its head, you know, and this is what makes the gospel a revolutionary text. It's telling us to enter into the world in an unworldly way, in a godly fashion, to enter in, into it in the same way that Christ entered into it. Not with force, but with this self-emptying love and humility. And, you know, we know what that meant for him, and to follow such a master who allows himself to be broken and poured out in love for the world means that, you know, our way of engaging others in the world is to be a reflection of that in some form or fashion. So even when we find ourselves having to engage others that are harsh or angry or narcissistic, bitter, you know, the way that we do that would be in a restrained fashion, even if there is a corrective that is offered, that, you know, that are, we aren't driven by, you know, rage and wrath and the desire for revenge, and that we, because our hearts are pure and have been purified, we are able to see, you know, who they bear within them and engage that great, deeper and greater reality. No matter what the external behavior might be, that we would not lose sight of that, the fundamental dignity that they have as human beings and as those who, for whom Christ has died. And, you know, it's very easy for us to slip out of that, you know, especially when someone seems to be getting in our way or like making our life more difficult or even persecuting us in some way. And it's very difficult to take that path, you know, where we aren't going to, you know, give back with greater force than what we even received. It's nothing short of heroic, you know, I think at times, not simply to react, but to allow ourselves to act out of this deeper place of that communion with God. So however we respond or whatever the result of that interaction is, that it's redemptive. You know, and we might not ever see that. You know, that's the thing that we have to keep in mind, that we might not see the fruit of our particular actions of showing charity or being humble in the face of another who's treating us poorly. We might only see their scorn or their contempt for us. And, you know, what if they become an obstacle to our pursuing the path that we want or that is enriching to us? You know, I think at those points we would feel justified in striking out because we worked hard for something, you know, but it's not necessarily what is in the mind of God. It's not necessarily doing it with a, responding with a godly disposition. Eric.
I often try to keep in mind that in the heat of battle, we don't rise to the level of our aspirations, we sink to the level of our training. And this would seem to be where prayer rules that start off first thing in the morning are so important, because that's sort of our training, our calisthenics, if you will, for the spiritual life, that if we can begin our day on the right footing, then when we encounter difficult people or difficult situations throughout the day, we might have a better chance of responding to them in a godly way.
Right. That's right. To be able to, you know, approach all things. And again, as he told her from the beginning of the letters, to subordinate everything to God. And so to begin the day, seeing everything through the lens of that relationship. I remember growing up, you know, Rocky had come out, and you know that music, dun, 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 and so, you know, when you're an athlete, the first thing you put on is music in the morning, is something like that to sort of get your blood flowing, you know. And so, you know, we're either all constantly in this fight or flight mode, you know, we're ready for battle or we're running scared, and there's something that's not very freeing about that. But I think when we are engaging in our life out of that relationship with God, then we're living within the peace of the kingdom here and now. And that is to be reflected in the way that we engage in our day-to-day work. Same with students. You know, I'll talk to them about this all the time, that, you know, your prayer life is not an obstacle to your studies. And in fact, just the opposite, you know, that our fear and our anxiety is what makes us drive ourselves to the point of exhaustion. And we usually end up doing worse for having pushed ourselves so hard. Whereas living in this deep relationship with God and having our hearts be enveloped in that peace allows us to see with a kind of clarity how it is that we are to engage in that work, engage in it with a kind of zeal and discipline and responsibility, but with freedom, because all of a sudden our identity isn't caught up in the grade that we make, you know, that our focus is more on, you know, the task at hand, doing it well, or learning whatever it is that we're studying. We're not being driven by fear, or we're not being driven by anxiety. And in our relationships with others, we can be driven by one or the other of those things, anxiety or anger. Shall I move on here? Let's see. What paragraph are we on? If you so dispose yourself, is that right? Yes, okay. If you so dispose yourself, then neither household chores or work outside the house will turn your mind away from God. On the contrary, it will stay fixed on him, and with the understanding that performing any given task is pleasing to God, you will do everything with the fear of God, and this fear will maintain unfailing attention toward God. So, you know, when we have this very clear sense, again, that what we are doing has been given to us by God, and that we are doing it for him, it's going to move our hearts toward him and keep us focused upon him, that we are anxious, as it were, to do this work in a way that's pleasing to God. And so the movement of the mind and the heart is going to be toward him in order that we might have the grace to be able to accomplish it in the way that he wills. And it's only when we lose sight of that, then we begin to start laboring under our own strength and our own will, and things become blurry or distorted for us. We lose this kind of clarity. You must resolve to understand thoroughly which occupations, both within the family and outside it, are pleasing to God, taking as guidance books in which suitable occupations are discussed. Understand this thoroughly, so that in your present living and social conditions, you distinguish what is suitable from all the things that have been introduced here as vanity, passions, pleasing to man, pleasing to the world. Of course, because you have expressed your resolve to live a God-pleasing life, you should eliminate things without any special reminders. And so, you know, again, you know, if our focus is on pursuing, you know, things to the best of our talents in order to accomplish all of these personal goals and goals that originate with us, and again, abstracted from God, then it's not necessarily going to bear fruit that is acceptable to the King, to God, or that will be pleasing to him. And, you know, there used to be a whole list of works that priests were not to be involved in. There was a part of canon law that it was certain works that would pull them away from what was fundamental to their ordination, or pull them into kinds of relationships, again, that would prevent them from maintaining that identity, that distinctive identity as priest. And the church sort of dropped that in the more recent canon law. And so it's never talked about. But, you know, I think this is true in a broader way, in the sense of what is it that we engage in? What goals do we set for ourselves? What kind of work do we seek for ourselves that is going to be make it possible for us to engage in life in such a way that we can even do that work in a God-pleasing way? So there will automatically be certain things that we would set aside because we know that it would be an obstacle to living a holy life, or it would be something that would be a near occasion of sin for us, that it would be so involving that it would prevent us from performing the more important and essential aspects of life. I think I remember telling you all once, somebody asking me about working on an oil rig where they would be out there for like 6 months at a time. And in that time, they would have no opportunity to go to Mass or go to confession, no opportunity to participate in the life of the sacraments. But the money was good. You know, it was going to be a great job, a great opportunity for this person. And it always seemed to me to be a great example, you know, of the kinds of choices that sometimes we're faced with. You know, are there certain jobs that we would not take because it would prevent us from engaging in the spiritual life fully, or would make it so difficult for us to do that that it wouldn't be worth it, or that it would undermine the more fundamental vocations, like you know, a married couple, you know, that this their that would be a fundamental, you know, out beyond their baptism and their vocation to live the Christian life, you know, that this is a fundamental vocation that shapes their identity. And so any work that they would take up in the world should not be such that it puts such a strain on the relationship, or on, and or if they have children, you know, makes it so difficult to care for them that they're unable to do that. And these are things that people aren't willing, I think, to ask themselves even the question about anymore. You know, that they'll find a way to make it work, you know, and we sort of praise and hold up this image of the one who can seemingly do everything, you know, manage all these, seems to manage all these things and be able to do, you know, to live this, you know, great existence where they can pursue all their individual goals and yet still do this, you know, be married and have a family. And yet it's not necessarily going to be something that's pleasing to God. And you know, husbands, you know, that there's often, you know, these tendencies to get drawn into these works or to, you know, the pull to move up the ladder, you know, within the company. And in such a way, you know, they'll feel driven even by the sense of doing it for the family. But there's always a kind of risk in that, in the sense that it's not thought through. What will this mean? You know, picking up and moving my family perhaps away from the extended family, or having to move, you know, constantly, or what if I have to be at my job, you know, 12, 15 hours a day or something like that, where I never see them, you know, what strain is that going to put on that relationship? And again, is the cost too great? And sometimes these things aren't talked about because there can be such a yearning to be able to pursue those particular paths and goals. And partly it's because the world tells us that these have this enormous value, and it diminishes, you know, the simpler things in life. Not everybody would agree with that. Nobody has any comment about that, or no disagreement? Was that a wave, or?
Yeah. I can't think clearly to put my little hand up, so I'm just going to turn on my video and wave. I was thinking, obviously the immediate example that's going to come up so much is like married with family, but I think for everyone out there who's not married, or doesn't have kids, especially, you know, it can be really easy to stay the like 12, 14 hours at work, because it's like, you know, oh, I don't have a family. I'm not neglecting anyone. I'm not hurting anyone by like pouring myself into work and killing myself for work. And even though I in no way am at a place where I'm living this, I think something I read that was so helpful about the single life is like, well, you're not single for yourself, and you're not even single for your work. Like, even if your work is really meaningful to you, even if it's like really good and does constitute the obedience part of your day-to-day activity, like a monk's physical labor would, like, that's not the reason you're single. And I think it can be very hard to stick to the prayer, because it's like, yeah, I think work can just become such a temptation there, especially without the family identity, then your whole identity can become work. And it can just so I think for everyone that danger is really there.
Right. The perpetual bachelor who just sort of pursues his own path, you know, again, not being mindful again of what God might be calling him to do or how he wants him to live his life in that context.
Lord forbid they work at a church, and so it's like really easy to pretend their work is prayer. You know? And everything goes crazy. It's like, I've been working for God all day. I'm not going to go pray now. Like,
that's why I make it my personal job to torture those who work for us just a little bit every day to, you know, so it's not.
Yeah, just a little. Yeah.
Catherine Memoli.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say that I agree with what you were saying about, you know, making those things a priority. I think it's a lot easier to prioritize like things we want to have or things we want to accomplish. Like, I want this title, or I want this position at work, or I want this much money, or I want this car. And a lot of people, not everyone has this skill, but a lot of people are able to map out tangible steps to get from point A to point B when it's something like a promotion or a car. But I think sometimes we can get a little lost, or we don't even give thought to like, what do I want to be? Like, not like a lawyer, but like, do I want to be a peaceful person? Do I want to be a loving person? How do I want my home to feel? Like, what do I want the spirit to be? And then giving just as much thought to like, well, what are the tangible goals I need to accomplish to make this happen, whether it's moving or scaling back at work, or, adding a prayer corner, adding certain routines, you know, checking in with people. Like, that requires like just as much labor. Like, just, you know, you talk about like setting a prayer rule. It's like, just loving people is a great start, but it's not necessarily going to get you from point A to point B. So I do think having that sense of like, what you actually need to do, like, what's my game plan here? It can feel weird when you're talking about something that seems like spiritual and emotional, but like, you know, I think it's like very necessary. And if you don't do it, like 20 years go by and you're like, where'd all my time go? And this is not the spirit of a home or family or whatever that I wanted to cultivate. So that's my more than two cents.
Yeah. I wouldn't, you know, I don't think we can sort of read his thoughts here as if he's saying that, again, you know, he emphasizes that this is part of the fabric of life itself as God has created it, you know, that we do have to work, we do have to engage in all these activities and relationships. But again, you know, it's the disposition with which we take those things up, and the origin of them for us, you know, in terms of our decisions about how we engage in them. And, you know, we don't want to lose sight of that. And again, the only way that we don't is, you know, by this constant remembrance of God. Because whether it's working for, you know, a religious institution or having, you know, a job within the world, you know, we can still get lost in that and lose sight of it.
Yeah. Well, and I just, a little addendum. I want to clarify, like, I'm not talking about micromanaging other people to create like faux Hallmark moments here, more about like looking to yourself, like, how can I improve to make things more like this? Just to be absolutely clear, because the former is very bad.
Yeah, I think keeping life simple is a way of doing that. I think once it becomes so full at some point, it almost feels like we can't get there any longer. Eric Chastain.
So I think there are actually some very interesting exceptions, and I think that the exception proves the rule more than anything else, but St. Louis, who was the king of France, you know, I think he went to two masses per day. He did the full round of the divine office at the time. I mean, I don't think he did matins, but I'm not sure. Maybe he did. Anyway, he did all of those things, and he was also the king of France. So one might think, oh, well, if you're, you know, really, really up and up in the world and stuff like that, you don't have time for any of these things. That's not true.
Well, he probably had to be cooking his meals and ironing his clothes.
Oh, no, for sure he was, you know. But I mean, he had all the time to do that.
Yeah, that's right.
And he was a third order Franciscan at the same time, too. So, that's right. Yeah.
I know. Yeah, you're right. And in some sense, you know, the busier we are, the more we have to pray, precisely that we don't get absorbed into it and lose sight of what he's talking about here. And our final comment tonight is from Daniel Allen.
And I'm going to preface this with saying I came in very late, so I've only heard like the end of this conversation. So I apologize if any of this is like not related, but more of a question on the end, because I feel like the King Louis example, for instance, it's a good example. And I also feel like it's completely irrelevant in a sense. Like I feel like the challenges in a sense, and this isn't to like try to not prove the point. This is like, I guess my question would be that I personally seem to think that the challenges that are faced today, while they're maybe not completely different from the past, like King Louis was the king of France, but he wasn't, you know, bombarded by constant stuff from a phone or from a computer. You know what I mean? Like it was a different type of work too, like society and people and culture and everything was different. And that's not an excuse, but it's like, I don't know. I do feel like it is, it's like, I understand and I see this. I also just think that like there are, it is more challenging. It doesn't disprove something, but a lot of times I feel like there's a lot of like, maybe it's an excuse, but it does feel very challenging, like in a different way today, you know, like people can't almost today, kind of like we aren't an agrarian society, for instance, you don't grow up in farm, so to say, very rarely, right? Like the society that was then. And it's actually really rare and difficult to like even be in like, this is my job. And I'm just going to, even if you are content with it, you know, like in modern society, because modern society grows discontent with you if you are content with your job, you know? And I don't know. It's just, it is a little unique, I feel like, in a bad way, almost like it's on purpose to make it hard for everyone.
Yeah, I get it. I think I get where you're coming from. And Thomas Merton saw that, you know, that there's the kind, you know, the busyness and the frenetic pace, he said, is the kind of violence that we do to ourselves in the modern age. And that it is a problem. That, you know, at times, you know, people at different times didn't experience for some of the reasons that you describe, that we've quickened the pace of everything and the immediacy of the need to respond to everything, that all of a sudden we feel that we lose a sense of humanity in it and normalcy, and our life seems to slide by us. And I think that's why we see so much depression and anxiety, because our life seems out of control and not directed towards anything in particular. You know, that we experience this kind of profound fragmentation internally, even if our life is put together or seemingly put together on the outside. Believe me, I've talked to a lot of people where their life looks perfect, and you know, internally the image is quite different. And part of it is the pressure that they're under, where they, you know, that there's a deep unhappiness there, because everything seems to keep them from what is important, or what in their mind they you know, they might not even be able to put their finger on it, but they have this sense that they're not living the kind of life that they're meant to and can't find their way out of it. So, you know, we went pretty far afield. I don't want to lose the simplicity of his message here, again, which is this disposition with which we enter into things, that this is what is meant to simplify things for us and give a kind of clarity to help us to make our way through what Daniel has said has become more and more difficult over time, because there are so many voices, you know, speaking to us and clamoring for our attention. Okay, so we're a little over time, so we'll stop there and we'll pick up next week with this letter. And so let's stop as always with our Father, in the name of the Father and of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. Amen. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. Amen. The Lord be with you.
And with your spirit.
Almighty God bless you, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen. Go in peace.
Thanks be to God.
Thanks be to God. Good to see you all.
See ya.
Thanks, brother.
Have a great week.
You too.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. We'll let you know when the books come in.
Sounds all good. Right.
Very excited.
So are we.
I'd like to thank everyone for the stellar messaging game going on tonight. I might have taken some pictures to save.
Father, you didn't answer my question, which is how do my chickens fit into this? I private messaged.
I'm sorry, I missed that one. We'll pick it up next time, okay?
Chickens don't have feelings. They're chickens.
Have a great night, everybody.
You too, Father.
Okay. Bye, Father David.
Bye-bye.
Night, Father.
Good night. Night, Mom.